Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A huge part of socializing in our culture is around food. And so a piece of work in recovery is practicing that flexibility. So being able to walk into a restaurant, not know what's on the menu, and then order something and eat it.
Katie Kopp Miller is a clinical psychologist with a specialty in eating disorders. Today, she sits down with Lee and Maddie of the Indiana University Food Institute for a frank conversation about restaurant culture, pop culture, and how gadgets like Fitbits can be problematic for people recovering from an eating disorder. We bring you another story that examines rural life in the middle of the country. From Harvest, it's about sex trafficking in Nebraska. And then in the kitchen, we kick off 5 shows of baking recipes with Daniel Orr's go-to biscuits. A brief news update, first of all, with Mark Chilla.
An update to a story we talked about last month. Scott Pruitt, the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, announced this week that his agency will not ban chlorpyrifos after all, despite its own evidence that the pesticide could pose risks to consumers. It's a signal that toxic chemicals will face less restrictive regulation by the Trump administration. As NPR's Dan Charles reported, the EPA said there's still a lot of scientific uncertainty about the risks of chlorpyrifos. And because of that uncertainty, the court had no right to set a firm deadline for a decision. The EPA says it will keep studying the chemical. Groups that help low-income families get food assistance are alarmed by a recent drop in the number of immigrants seeking help. Some families are even canceling their food stamps and other government benefits for fear that receiving them will affect their immigration status or lead to deportation. As NPR reported this week, advocates say the concerns seem to be twofold. Unauthorized immigrants are worried about getting deported if they receive benefits for their children, and lawful permanent residents are worried that receiving government aid will jeopardize their chances of becoming citizens. There's no evidence either of those things will happen, but rumors have been flying. And forget that chicken that crossed the road. A new chicken is in town, or is it a chicken at all? San Francisco-based tech startup Memphis Meats has figured out a way to make chicken and duck products without actually killing any animals. Instead, the company makes nuggets and tenders using self-reproducing cells, taken from live animals and grown in laboratory-based bioreactor tanks. Chicken and duck are the most slaughtered animals by humans for food across the globe, and the average American eats about 90 pounds of poultry per year. Traditional livestock production has dramatic climate consequences, and for some, ethical concerns. Memphis Meats says they expect it to be ready for commercial sale by 2021. These articles are at eartheats.org, along with a very cool story about the rise of the American tea farm. I'm Simple Annie. I like black tea.
Oh, yeah? Give me mint tea any day. Okay, Mark, get out of here.
All right, see you next week.
Rural voters overwhelmingly chose Donald Trump in the presidential election. But when it comes to one central campaign promise, getting tough on trade, rural voters are not always in sync with the administration. As part of Harvest Public Media's series United and Divided, Grant Gerlach went to a rural Nebraska town to understand voters' competing views on trade.
Farmer Don Beatty fires up a dusty Freightliner hitched to a flatbed trailer. He's headed to pick up a load of hay bales, so I ride along. We rattle down a gravel road through flat farm fields in the Platte River Valley in Dawson County, Nebraska.
My great-grandparents came here 144 years ago from England and homesteaded just a mile south of where we are right now.
Beatty wears glasses and a green ball cap. He's 58, but says that makes him one of the younger farmers around. He and his wife farm about 1,500 acres of mostly corn and soybeans. They're raising more grain than ever before, but it's not paying off right now.
We'll probably end up losing money for the year, and unfortunately that's kind of the way agriculture goes. We have boom and bust.
I'm in Dawson County because, like most of rural America, Donald Trump won a big majority here, 70%. But it's also a good place to look at one issue where rural residents have different perspectives. That's trade. Don Beatty supports President Trump, even though he knows Trump's trade proposals could spell more trouble for the struggling farm economy. We step into a farm shed where he tells me what his business needs is higher commodity prices. One way to do that is more trade.
That is one of the concerns that I and many of my fellow farmers have with the Trump administration is what he's been saying on trade. You know, he wants to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement. He vetoed or canceled the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement.
Many voters saw the TPP as a path to outsourcing, but it would have made American farm exports cheaper in much of Asia. And then there's President Trump's campaign proposal to put big tariffs on Chinese imports. China is a huge market for U.S. farmers, so they worry about a trade war.
I am a free trader. That means that I think we ought to be able to sell our goods to other countries. They ought to be able to sell their goods to us.
But then on the other side of Dawson County, there's Junior Dishman. He likes where President Trump is going with trade.
I'll take you to the far side. We'll just go around. It kind of looks like a bomb went off right now.
Dishman is driving me to the edge of Cozad, a small city in Dawson County, to see what's left of the former Tenneco factory. He worked at the factory for 40 years, making shock absorbers mostly for car companies. Now it's demolished. A salvage company is combing through piles of bricks and insulation to pull out scraps of steel and copper. Dishman looks out from under his black cowboy hat and points out a landmark in the rubble.
There's a pile over there. I think the desk is still there with the keys still laying on the desk. They just knocked it down on top of it.
Like farmer Don Beatty, Junior Dishman voted for Trump. But those import tariffs that Beatty is worried about, Dishman thinks they could help American workers compete with cheap labor overseas.
If they do start charging, let's say, China and all them tariffs and things for bringing their product back in, the cost will offset and then they can get jobs back in here.
Dishman knows farming is the biggest industry around Cozad, but Tenneco was the town's biggest single employer. At one time, he says, 750 people worked here in a town of around 4,000. He says many young families followed jobs out of town. Older workers with deeper roots stayed.
But they had to take a hit in their wages and in the insurance, and it affected the town quite a bit. It really did. It was like a lifeline here. It was a heartbeat, I think.
He doesn't want to see farmers suffer, but a lot of small towns have factories like this, and he wants to see them stay open. That's what makes trade policy difficult. Even when people here agree on most things, trade involves trade-offs that cut different ways through rural America. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
United and Divided is a Harvest Public Media series on bridging the urban-rural divide. To see more stories, visit harvestpublicmedia.org/united. At some point in their lives, 20 million American women and 10 million American men will suffer from a clinically significant eating disorder. That could be anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, or OSFED, that's other specific feeding and eating disorders. Psychologist Katie Kopp-Miller specializes in working with people age 13 and older who are receiving treatment for or are in recovery from an eating disorder. Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the Indiana University Food Institute have a professional interest in food, in restaurant culture, and in the community we make around food. Dr. Miller, today, offers a different way of looking at our 21st century world of food. First up, it's Maddie.
The concern about healthy behavior like eating and exercising is so pervasive in our culture, and it's, you know, in general, makes sense. It's a good thing. How does one know whether they're within the bounds of like a healthy attitude towards those things?
Especially since all women have concerns about their bodies, it just seems to be pretty natural in our culture to think about our body image on a semi-regular basis.
Yes. And men too.
And men too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think of body image on a continuum. Mm-hmm. So on the one end, you have body positivity, where you feel good about your body, you're confident, you own it. And then on the other end, you have body disparagement. And then in between, you have various grades of body dissatisfaction or negative body image. So in the U.S., it's common for women to have mild body dissatisfaction. It's brief, it's fleeting, maybe it comes up from time to time, but it doesn't ruin your day or doesn't really drive your day-to-day behaviors. For someone with an eating disorder, they're more on that body disparagement end of the continuum. So they feel repulsed by their body. They feel disgusted about their body. And it really drives behaviors. So it drives those restricting behaviors or over-exercising behaviors. And then in terms of the behaviors themselves with eating or exercising, really looking at the function and dysfunction of it. So is there a sense of well-being in that person's life? Are they able to function well at work or in relationships versus is this the center of their life? Is it actually dysfunctional? So with someone with an eating disorder, kind of food is everything because body shape and size is everything. And your ability to control your body shape and size is everything.
I sometimes wonder because food is the center of our world to some extent. Do you know or have you observed any difference between people that are just really into food and an overlap with eating disorders?
Yeah, that's a really good kind of distinction to point out. So with someone with an eating disorder, food is a means to have control over your shape and weight. And so with someone who's just really interested in food, the function or purpose of food is probably really different. It probably doesn't have as much to do with controlling your shape and weight. It might be more about, you know, pleasure or cooking or restaurants. And so that's the real difference, because the core pathology of an eating disorder is your over-evaluation of your body shape and weight. And so, again, placing your self-worth and your body shape and size, and then the over-evaluation of your sense of control over it. So people with eating disorders believe that they have much more control over their shape and size than they actually do. And food is just kind of a means of controlling that shape and size.
I'm kind of wondering what you think of the technologies that have come up relating to body weight management, because I feel like it's very socially acceptable these days for everyone, including my mother, to have a watch on that tells you exactly how much exercise you've gotten in a given day. And along with that, you can record your calories and you can compare all day long. And it's all over the media as sort of a healthy way to manage your eating life and exercise life. Do you have an opinion about this?
Oh, I do. You got Fitbits and MyFitnessPal. They are like the bane of my existence professionally. Just that, I mean, people with eating disorders really, those apps can really facilitate restricting and over-exercising and measuring. And so with someone with an eating disorder, it's hard for them to use that in an appropriate, reasonable, functional way. It's much more likely to be triggering and to be taken to this very obsessive, rigid, perfectionistic place. Now, there are other apps. There's the Rise Up app, which is for people in recovery. So it's a way to log your food that does not have anything to do with calories or amounts, and then it has kind of inspirational messages that are embedded in the app. So there can't be positives, you know, positive
really
uses
cool.
of technology.
Yeah. It seems like technology too is implicated in kind of a bit of a generation gap that might be part of the dynamic between parents and adolescents. We were talking earlier about the thigh gap phenomenon and how a lot of people in the older generation kind of miss some of these trends or things that are influencing young people in how they think about their bodies and their activities.
And you're right. I mean, you're speaking to, like, there's trends in bodies. So, like, the thigh gap, like, that's a trend.
Or what is the thigh gap exactly?
The thigh gap is where the thighs don't touch. So the person stands with their legs together and the thighs aren't touching.
Which is rare, is it not, for a woman?
Yes. So physiologically, the body's, you know, in the body, the thighs touch, unless you are bow-legged or there's something else going on physiologically. And if you're malnourished and very underweight, you might have a thigh gap. And so a lot of models or a lot of celebrities, you know, might post pictures that show a thigh gap. And so that kind of feeds into this, well, I should have a thigh gap. There's something wrong with me that I don't have a thigh gap, even though I actually, that's because a person is under eating and malnourished that they have a thigh gap.
Or photoshopped. Kind
exactly. Of. Yeah. The other piece I've noticed is that, you know, in the 90s, there was the heroin chic of being very, very thin and kind of gaunt. And now there's a movement toward women being strong, and strong is the new skinny. And that can also be just another version of an unattainable standard. So now it's not being thin, it's I have to be thin and sculpted and very muscular.
One thing we were wondering is, so, you know, we're focused on food here at Earth Eats and at the Indiana University Food Institute. And eating out and restaurant culture is oftentimes a big part of being both an adolescent, but especially as you start to live on your own. Is there any way that eating disorders sort of interact with that culture of eating out?
Yes, that's such a good question. So that is such a common piece of work with someone moving into recovery, that it's very difficult to spontaneously go out and get ice cream with friends or go grab dinner with friends, or if they don't know what restaurant it's going to be and what the menu is going to look like. So I'll often be working with people who will look up the menu ahead of time and kind of really figure out what they're going to eat. And there are some social situations where that's not possible, and that can feel very triggering and anxiety provoking, and that can lead the person to cancel on plans or to not make plans that are centered around food, which can lead to social withdrawal, because a huge part of socializing in our culture is around food. And so a piece of work in recovery is practicing that flexibility. So being able to walk into a restaurant, not know what's on the menu, and then order something and eat it. Or being able to go grab ice cream with friends. Because it really limits your participation in community when you're not able to do that.
Great. Thanks so much, Katie.
Yeah, thank you so much, Katie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Maddie Chera and Lee Bush of the IU Food Institute speaking with clinical psychologist Dr. Katie Kopp Miller. For more information on treatment for eating disorders, visit the National Eating Disorder Association website, which is nationaleatingdisorders.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. This is Earth Eats. Thousands of people are sold for sex in the United States each year, but where sex trafficking happens may surprise you. It's not just a big city problem. Mike Tobias reports for Harvest Public Media. Please note that this story deals with subject matter of an adult nature.
For most of our trafficking victims, this is kind of where we're going to start as far as once we've triaged.
Jamie Manzer gave me a tour last summer of the SASA Crisis Center. It helps domestic and sexual violence victims. That includes women sold against their will for sex. We're in SASA's gifts room, stocked with basics like soap, toothpaste, and T-shirts.
Most of our trafficking victims feel dirty, and that's more symbolic than realistic.
SASA is a first point of contact for people escaping trafficking. Manzer led the organization for several years. During one, they saw 14 sex trafficking victims. If that doesn't get your attention, try this. SASA is located in Hastings, a central Nebraska city of 25,000. The agency serves mostly rural counties.
What we're typically seeing are acquaintances, partners, prostituting out their intimate partner, most typically a male pimping out a female, though that's not always the case. And what we're seeing is it's for drugs, it's for alcohol, it's for access to shelter.
Manzer says they once helped women being trafficked in a town of just 500 people. They've seen women being trafficked at a county fair, even the state fair in Grand Island.
For the state fair, we did have three ladies brought on motorcycle from Daytona Beach, Florida, into the community, locked in hotels for multiple days. And then the gentleman who'd brought them there, who they thought they knew and thought were acquaintances of theirs, brought multiple men in, blindfolded them, forced them to have sex. So they couldn't even tell me who they'd had sex with, how many times.
It happens virtually anywhere.
Stephen O'Mara was the Nebraska Attorney General's first human trafficking coordinator.
Even if you just followed the major interstate system that all the way from Omaha out through Scotts Bluff, there is measurable sex trafficking that occurs virtually all the time, particularly during major events, but all the time across all of Nebraska.
Although it's faced legal challenges, the classified ads website Backpage is still one of the places buyers are looking and traffickers are selling. Backpage's dating area includes listings that leave little to the imagination, One typical ad offers a, quote, classy and erotic woman available in North Platte, population 25,000.
The commercial sex market is strong across the state.
Krista Price and Terry Clark from Creighton University's Human Trafficking Initiative are giving us a presentation of their research on the area's commercial sex industry. It's based on a deep dive analysis of thousands of Backpage posts. They found 900 people are sold for sex each month in Nebraska. Almost all are female. Some are likely involved in voluntary prostitution, but three-fourths have some signs of being trafficked. A map shows where sex is for sale in Nebraska. There's lots of activity in the state's larger cities, but also indications of activity in places like Valley and St. Paul, towns of just 2,000.
If a worker or trafficker, whoever's posting, is name-checking a town, they're basically saying, we've had success there before in our business
model. There has to be a reason they're singling out the town. There's got to be a clientele there. And it wouldn't be one or two people.
Stephen O'Mara.
If there's any kind of a viable prostitution market, there is almost certainly sex trafficking in that location. And the reality is there is a viable prostitution market adjusted for population virtually everywhere.
The Creighton research shows levels of per capita commercial sex activity similar to Nebraska in states like Minnesota, Kansas, and Iowa. And a map from the Polaris Project, an organization that fights human trafficking, shows known trafficking cases in rural areas of every Midwestern state last year. Fighting sex trafficking is difficult anywhere, but there are special challenges in rural areas, including frontline agencies with limited resources and training. Jamie Manzer of SASA says it's hard for trafficking victims to privately get help in small towns, and isolation of victims in rural areas is a common tool used by traffickers. Her message? Sex is for sale everywhere, and
that every time you're looking at a prostitute, you're probably looking at a victim of human trafficking.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Mike Tobias.
That story was produced by NET Nebraska. More at harvestpublicmedia.org. Happy April, everybody. We're giving you a new series of recipes this month, baking recipes. And let me tell you that we've got some good stuff planned for the weeks ahead. Today, first of all, it's a basic recipe for biscuits. One of Daniel Orr's most delicious and most requested recipes, in fact. Here's how he does it.
A lot of people get nervous whenever they bake, especially yeast breads and raised rolls. But you got to start somewhere, and why not with biscuits or pancakes? I'm going to show you the recipe for my grandma's buttermilk biscuits. It's a fourth generation recipe that's been in my family in southern Indiana. We used to feed the farmhands that when they would come in from the fields. Now you better hold it just for the weekends and enjoy them once a month. So the flour's chilled. I've got these nice pea-sized pieces of butter. Sometimes I even put them in the freezer just to make sure they're really nice and ice cold. Okay, we're going to add our salt, baking soda, baking powder, and sugar. And the recipe is as simple as that. Now what we're going to do is just kind of mix all those ingredients together. And then I'm going to take my biscuit cutter and just start cutting up those pieces of butter until it becomes almost like a coarse cornmeal. And the reason you want the butter coarse is it's actually going to melt and steam, and that's going to give some part of your rise to your biscuits, so they're nice, light, and fluffy. So once we have this fairly coarsely cut up, and there's still some nice big chunks of butter in there, we're going to add our buttermilk. If you don't have buttermilk, you can take regular milk and just add about a tablespoon of vinegar per cup, and that will instantly turn your milk into buttermilk. I'm going to add about 3/4 of the milk in, and then I'm just going to kind of toss the mixture together, and you're just going to mix it enough to bring the dough together. You don't want to overmix it. You don't want to heat the dough up. Okay, and that's about a perfect dough. You can see the butter chunks still inside. You haven't overworked it. We're going to put it down on the counter with a little bit of flour. Pat it out till it's about the same thickness as your dough cutter. You don't want to twist your cutter, because what that will do is it will break up your little layers of butter that we spoke about earlier. So when you look at the biscuit, you should see those nice layers of butter on the inside. And then what you always want to do is to make sure at the end you have some scraps like this. And those you just kind of break up and you cook those on the side, and those are for the cook. And then we'll have some wonderful biscuits to have our apple butter on.
He said, pancakes? So let's make pancakes too. We've got eggs, flour, baking soda, but then also bananas and a variety of hemp products, hemp flour and oil, and some crunchy little hemp seeds.
It's a very simple recipe. We're going to start with some banana as part of our liquid ingredient. A couple eggs in here. We've got a quarter cup of flour, and we got a pinch of salt, a pinch of sugar, and then we're going to add a quarter cup of the hemp protein powder.
What does this stuff taste like?
It's very, very mild. It doesn't taste like a dirty bong or anything like that. The seeds are also very, very neutral. They just add a little crunchiness and some texture. We're just going to mash all this together. We're not adding any dairy to this. So now we'll just go over to the stove and we'll start cooking these up. Now the oil, as you'll see, is a very clear, neutral colored oil.
This is hemp oil.
This is hemp oil. Put a nice big pancake in each pan. You could also make these into little silver dollar pancakes, but we're just all gonna split these big ones today. Brown them off on one side. Top them with those hemp seed kernels. And that's gonna give us a nice little crunch once we flip them over.
Would you just eat these raw, just straight out of the bag?
Yeah, you eat them right out of the bag, sprinkle them on salad, just kind of like you would wheat germ. You know, a lot of people, especially from my generation, all of us hippies used to eat wheat germ. They're starting to get nice and brown. Now these will be a little bit more tender than a regular pancake because there's not as much flour in them, there's no dairy in them.
Right, oh, those are beautiful. Nice. They don't look green so much at all anymore. They're a nice dark brown.
And there we go. Those are our hemp seed and banana pancakes with fresh berries and local honey. Bon appetit.
Nice. We've got another pancake recipe on the site that incorporates some wild rice. That one's pretty cool and can go beyond breakfast. Find it at eartheats.org. Just search for pancakes. The man in the kitchen at Farm Bloomington Restaurant is Daniel Orr, thanks to him and all his staff. Aabon Binder snaps the gorgeous pictures on our website. Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Taylor Killo make the news happen. And we also partner with Harvest Public Media and the Indiana University Food Institute. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm your host and I'm your producer. I'm Annie Corrigan, and thank you for listening.